Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies with history. Today, I thought it would be fun to do something a little different, because instead of learning about the real history behind a movie, we're going to learn more about the history of Hollywood itself with none other than George Stevens Jr. Now, George has worked on historical films such as 1959's The Diary of Anne Frank and 1998's The Thin Red Line, so I'm sure we'll talk to him about those. But he's also the founder of the American Film Institute, co-creator of the Kennedy Center Honors, and he was director of the United States Information Agency in Washington, D.C. I could go on and on. George's career is the kind that has too many accolades to list. And it's something that the film industry recognized at the 85th Academy Awards in 2012 when they announced an honorary Oscar goes to George Stevens Jr., a tireless champion of the arts in America, and especially that most American of arts, the Hollywood film. George's book is called My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. And today we'll be chatting with him about some of the history that he's lived. Before we connect with George, though, it's time to set up our game, Two Truths and a Lie. Now, if you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to give you three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them is just going to be, it's just going to be an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one, George was the first to see the morning of D-Day in color since those who were there that day. Number two, the name, My Place in the Sun, is an homage to George's father. Number three, JFK never talked to George. Got him? Okay, now as you're listening to the stories today, your challenge is to identify which one of those is the lie. And then, of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. All right. Now it's time to learn about some Hollywood history with George Stevens Jr. Everyone knows that movies are a form of entertainment. So when it comes to films that are based on a true story, we don't expect them to have the same sort of historical accuracy as a documentary would. And yet, there's a lot of overlap in the kind of storytelling required to make a feature film compared to a documentary film. And since you've spent your career working in both movies for Hollywood and documentaries in Washington, can you share some of the differences that you'd put into making a documentary, kind of making sure that that's accurate, that a feature film may not get?
Sure. And there are obviously many variations. When I was working in Washington during the New Frontier, Edward R. Murrow was running the United States Information Agency under President Kennedy, and he asked me to come back and run the motion picture division of USIA. And we made about 300 documentaries a year with a lot of new then and fascinating filmmakers. And I felt quite an obligation with those films that we be historically accurate. We were representing the United States. We were telling America's story abroad. And for example, we made a film on the March on Washington that James Blue directed that was extremely well received. We made a film called Nine from Little Rock about the nine students who entered Little Rock High School when it was segregated under Governor George Wallace. And, you know, there was a lot of abuse when they were brought to the school. And we told the stories of their lives after they got out of graduated from Little Rock High. So in that realm, accuracy seemed very important. I made a film called George Stevens, D-Day to Berlin, about my father, George Stevens, the director who headed combat photography for General Eisenhower in the war in Europe. And two, there I felt an obligation, you know. In fact, I'm trying to think of a documentary I would make when I didn't feel that, George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey, which will have its 40th anniversary next year, is the film I made about my father, telling the story of his life and career. And again, I wanted that to be accurate. And we could talk about miniseries for television. Do you want to explore that?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I did two of those. Both were based on factual stories. I'll talk about the second first, which was called Separate But Equal. It starred Sidney Poitier as Thurgood Marshall and Burt Lancaster as John W. Davis and Richard Kiley as former governor of California, Earl Warren. It was the story of Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court case that made segregated schools unlawful. In that case, I felt a very strict obligation to be accurate. I made it for ABC Television, sponsored by General Motors. And ABC had a very strict, called program practices, unit within the network that required factual programs to be factual. And I had a good deal of contest with them because they were preventing me from doing things that I believed and was confident were accurate. So we worked with them, and eventually I did everything I wanted to do, but it was very important that it be accurate. The other was called The Murder of Mary Fagan, which Jack Lemmon starred in, along with Peter Gallagher and Kevin Spacey and Rebecca Miller. And that was a story of a Jewish factory manager in Georgia in 1914 who was accused and convicted of murdering a young woman by the name of Mary Fagan, who worked in his factory. We did great research on that, and in every respect, made it as accurate as possible. However, it being a dramatized situation, we took certain liberties in writing the parts of Leo Frank and his wife, because however many years later, there was not any precise detail. We had to create dialogue. So I could not claim that that was factually precise, but I felt it was a reasonable presumption in terms of what they said and did.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. TuneIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with TuneIn. Download TuneIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the TuneIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. TuneIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, TuneIn.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
As I was reading your book, one of the stories that really jumped out to me was when you traveled to Europe with your father after World War II to see places like Dachau and the beaches of Normandy, his first time back since he landed there with the Allied forces on D-Day. How did the stories from your father's experiences during the war affect your filmmaking?
Well, we were about to make The Diary of Anne Frank, which he directed and produced, and I was the associate producer and the director of the location scenes in Amsterdam. And he had, of course, firsthand experience in the war. And again, with The Diary of Anne Frank, we wanted to be accurate. We had the benefit of her diary. We had the benefit of talking to Otto Frank, her father. And I'm quite comfortable that is a film that is meets the high standards of accuracy. In my own work, I mentioned the two earlier films, George Stevens' D-Day to Berlin, and obviously I was very influenced by what he had told me, and it helped me be confident that I was presenting an accurate picture.
What was it like? You mentioned in your book that you found your father's color footage from World War II. Can you kind of take us back to what that moment was like?
I will tell you, I knew that footage was there in Beacon storage, and I'd seen the film cans, but he never really wanted to watch it after the war. You know, he'd come home, was in a different mindset. But after his death, I was proposed that I write a book. And I looked at all those cans of film that were in North Hollywood, and I asked that one be sent to me when I returned to Washington. And one afternoon, I went into a screening room by myself and gave the can of film to the projectionist in the projection booth. And these images came on the screen. They were beautiful, kind of gray morning images and what were called barrage balloons, those huge objects that stood in the sky to intercept airplanes were in the sky. And I realized, because of the label on the film that said D-Day to Cats, I don't know what Cats was, that this was June the 6th, 1944, and it was in color. And I realized that other than those who had been there on that day, I was the first one to see the morning of D-Day in color. And it was so moving. And it was footage taken on the HMS Belfast, which was a British ship that was the flagship of that greatest seaborne invasion in history. And it was the ship that would fire the first barrage at 0500 in the morning onto the Normandy beaches. And I'm watching it and I see men on the deck. And all of a sudden, around a bulkhead comes a man in flak gear and all of this and a helmet. And it's my 37-year-old father, on the ship preparing for D-Day, and he goes to a 35-millimeter camera and looks through the lens, and that's the 35-millimeter cameras that would record the landing. And a colleague was shooting this sort of behind-the-scenes footage that was not official, that introduced my father to me on that day. Within the 20 minutes I spent watching that D-Day footage, I decided that I wasn't going to write a book. I was going to make a film about my father.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen that. It's a fascinating film, and getting to see some of that footage in color. I mean, there's stuff from World War II that has been colorized, of course, but it's not the same.
No, it's not. And Steven Spielberg acquired all of that film from the Library of Congress. I felt an obligation to put the film, about 3 hours of color film of the war, in the Library of Congress so other filmmakers could use it without cost. And I know that Steven and Janusz Kaminski, his brilliant cameraman, screened it in preparation of shooting Saving Private Ryan.
You mentioned earlier the Diary of Anne Frank, and that's another story I wanted to ask you about. What was it like getting to talk to Otto Frank and seeing the place? You mentioned in your book that you actually, you know, saw the place where he and his family hid from the Nazis, and that also had to have been very moving.
Well, it was. We went to, after we visited Dad and I, the Normandy beaches, we went to Amsterdam and went to a small office in the city one morning, rang the doorbell, and the door was opened by Otto Frank, over 6 foot tall, then in his 60s, had balding with gray hair. He had been an officer in the German army in World War I and returned as a citizen of Germany, and then faced the matter of having to wear a yellow star and all the other abuses. And he took his family to Amsterdam, and he started a spice business in a five-story building. And he was a very pleasant man. And we went in and sat down, and he was looking at the man who was going to be telling his daughter's story on film. But he was extremely gracious. And after a while, he went to a filing cabinet. He opened it and he came back with something wrapped in cloth and unfurled the cloth. And there, before my father and me, was Anne Frank's diary.
Wow.
With the pictures pasted in, her handwriting. And it was just so moving to see this work of a girl written between the ages of 12 and 14. That would eventually be read by, I believe, 70 million people, and how her voice replaced that of Adolf Hitler. His became silent and hers became heard around the world. And then we went with Otto Frank to 263 Prinzenkrop, the street on a canal where the spice factory was in a row of buildings. And Otto Frank took us into the now deserted building, and we climbed the steps to that top floor behind a false bookcase where they hid for nearly 2 years. I write about this all in my book, which is called My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. And within the book is a picture of me holding Anne Frank's diary and a picture of my father climbing the steps to that attic with Otto Frank. And behind the bookcase, he told us the story of the day that the green police came to arrest them. And they, you know, were terrifying them. And they found his briefcase in which he kept the money, the jewelry, and other documents of importance. And they just shook it all out on the floor. And they gathered up the money and they gathered up the jewelry and all the valuables. But they left on the floor all this spew of papers they spilled out of the bag. And they left the evidence. They left Anne Frank's diary on the floor. And it was recovered.
Wow. And you mentioned Washington in the title of your book. And you went from making movies in Hollywood to working in Washington, working for the United States Information Agency with the documentaries you mentioned there. Was it more challenging to faithfully tell stories at movie studios, you know, driven by budgets and things? And not that there's not budgets in Washington, but there's an extra layer of political pressure. Was it more difficult to make things faithfully there to tell the stories?
And no, it wasn't. First of all, I was working under Edward R. Murrow, who was a man of such integrity and somebody you wanted behind you. And he was behind me and encouraged me to be bold and to bring in new filmmakers. It was clear to me, you know, I was very impressed with President Kennedy, of course, and came to know him a bit and speak to him on the phone a couple of times. And it was just an opportunity. President Kennedy, I wrote down a lot of what he said at the time because he had this eloquence and grace of language. One thing, he was fascinated by Greek poetry. There's a book, I think, by Edith Hamilton called The Greeks. And he recited a line that I wrote down, and it was the Greek definition of happiness: the fullest use of one's powers along lines of excellence would create happiness. And I realized that that is the opportunity that he and Murrow had given me. I was very happy having the responsibility to make these films and try to make them as excellent as possible. So it was it turned out to be a wonderful situation to have that responsibility and that position.
Speaking of JFK, I know you worked with JFK, of course, but you know, you worked with presidents from JFK to Obama and everybody in between. What's one of your favorite stories of an American president?
One is that we made a film called The Five Cities of June in 1963, which covered four cities and Berlin. With the coronation of the Pope in Rome was one of them, the launching of a Soviet astronaut, a female, was another. But President Kennedy appeared in Berlin before 500,000 people at the Berlin Wall and made his famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech. And this film was made in 35 millimeter color, and it was really people simply were fascinated by it, and it was very moving. And I was in Edward R. Murrow's meeting of senior officers one afternoon, and my deputy came into the office and handed me a note. And I looked at the note, and I kind of nodded at Murrow and excused myself. And my office was one flight below Murrow's. And as I walked into my office, my secretary said, "I will call back Mrs. Lincoln." And I sat down and held the phone, and on came Evelyn Lincoln, the president's personal secretary. And she said, "I'll put the president on." And the next thing I hear is, "George, I saw The Five Cities of June last night. I think it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. How many places is it being shown? How many languages?" You know, he had a rat-a-tat of questions, and all of which I answered. And then he said, "Keep up the good work." And he was gone. But it was, you know, I never anticipated I would be speaking on the phone with the president. And I went back to Murrow's office and took the place of my deputy, who had informed the group of why I had been taken out of the meeting. And Murrow said, "Well, do you want to tell us about your recent experience?" And I described the president's curiosity and approval of our work. And it was so moving to me to see these senior foreign service officers who'd been in many governments and how gratified and moved they were to know that the president was actively looking at the work we produced at USIA.
What a great reason to leave the meeting too and call from the president. That's a With your days as the founding director of the American Film Institute in Hollywood, you helped preserve and restore thousands and thousands of films. How did you go about deciding what films to restore and preserve?
The first thing we did in starting that project was to meet with archivists from the Museum of Modern Art, George Eastman House, the Library of Congress, and our own archivists that I had engaged for AFI. And we made a rescue list of 175 movies that they considered the most important of the missing films. And in those days, studios and producers, they were moving right on to the next film, and they didn't have any idea that films would be shown again in later years. So, and film was produced in those years on nitrocellulose film stock that over time would deteriorate and could turn into dust in a film can. So all of those films needed to be reproduced on the new acetate film that would last forever. So if we had people, two really kind of film sleuths, I called them, who would go around archives and storerooms and studios looking for these films. And then we made an arrangement with the Library of Congress that we would deposit them there for preservation. And they are now part of the American Film Institute collection at the Library of Congress that numbers, I believe, 50,000 motion pictures.
Wow.
So AFI played a decisive role with many allies doing that work.
Was the thought process back then for filmmaking that you say in the moving on to the next one, was the thought process that these are almost, the films are almost temporary?
Yeah, sort of yesterday's newspaper.
Okay. Because I think of now, like, I mean, now we think of, you know, this classic movies that have been around for a long time. And so you kind of assume that a movie that's made now is also going to be around for a long time. And so it's maybe just a different mindset, it sounds like.
It's a different mindset. And it's one of the virtues of the creation of AFI, which is still doing this work. And Martin Scorsese has a film foundation, and they are doing the work. There are many people involved in this, but it got its national impetus from the American Film Institute, and we are proud of that.
So, yeah, do you think the AFI then kind of helped make that change in mindset to where today people assume that movies are going to be around longer?
I would say arguably that more than any other institution or people, it was the AFI founded in 1967 that did that.
That's fascinating. I wanted to kind of shift and talk about another movie that you worked on, The Thin Red Line, because I talked to a historian recently about that one. It's one of his favorite World War II movies because it is so different than other World War II movies. And you were on, in your book, you talk about, you know, being on sets in the Australian rainforest for the entire 5 months of shooting that film. Can you share some of your stories from the set of The Thin Red Line?
Well, Terrence Malick directed it and wrote it. And Terry had a kind of distinct way of working. He liked a kind of visual spontaneity. Hmm. And he worked with John Toll, an Oscar-winning cinematographer, one of the best. And they would plan scenes, but there would be occasion when Terry would tap John on the shoulder and say, come over here, and he'd find an alligator or a beautiful bird or some piece of wildlife that was, you know, important to the setting there in Guadalcanal, a largely uninhabited island of which the American troops were fighting to take away from the occupiers, the Japanese army. And so it was always adventurous with Terry. And he worked carefully with the actors and gave them an opportunity to find their roles and get into them. It was a very productive experience.
Another form of storytelling that I'm curious about has to do with the in-person productions. So, for example, the Kennedy Center Honors, which you produced and wrote since you created them in 1978 until 2014. And then in your book, you know, you mentioned the Obama inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, Christmas in Washington. So for those, I imagine it's a different type of challenge because not only are you creating the story for an audience that's viewing them on screen, but also the in-person live event, you're almost creating the story at the same time as you're telling the story. What were some of the challenges that were unique to that type of production?
That's a very good analysis. I would add to that the American Film Institute Life Achievement Award, which was the first of these that I did when we created the Life Achievement Award to acknowledge lifetime achievement, films that in the vernacular of the Stevens family stand the test of time. And John Ford was the first, James Cagney the second, Orson Welles, and Betty Davis and David Lean and William Wyler and John Huston and on and on, up till today, though I no longer produce it. I produced the first 25, where Nicole Kidman will be honored. Two things. One, you are doing it for a live audience. You must serve that audience, which is often not the case. We had a rule, we were doing it for the people in the auditorium, and we didn't do retakes, we didn't ask them to do something, perform. They were our audience as well as our cameras. And that was a very good instinct because I think it kept them at a high caliber and kept the audience engaged. Well, first, you have to do the research on the AFI honoree or on the five honorees of the Kennedy Center Honors or the history of American inaugurations for Obama's inauguration. Each one is different. Each one requires excellent collaborators. I wrote and produced most of them with another writer, various over the years, had a series of very fine directors working on them. And it's just a job of trying to figure out how to tell that story most interestingly. For the Kennedy Center Honors, our secret weapon was we made 5-minute films about the honorees. So someone would come in knowing who Cary Grant was, but they may not have known who Agnes DeMille, the great choreographer, was. But once they'd seen the 5-minute film, all the audience was in the same place and was able to enjoy the tributes that followed. And we worked very hard on those films, and they are really, if I do say so, kind of tiny masterpieces. They really capture the nature and the achievement. And often they're very moving because these artists overcame obstacles to become who they were. It's a disappointment to me that once my son Michael and I stopped producing the honors, they abandoned the biographies. And I think the audience has a much lesser experience because they never understand the depth and scope of the achievement of these. I remember the first one we showed was in the first honors in 1978, when Arthur Rubinstein, Marian Anderson, George Balanchine, Richard Rodgers of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and Fred Astaire were the honorees. And the first one recognized was Marian Anderson. And you saw, and we didn't show the films on little monitors. We made it like Radio City Music Hall. It went dark and the screen filled the stage in the dark. And you saw Marian Anderson, heard her sing as a young artist, heard her sing at the Metropolitan Opera, and the sequence where she was banned from performing at Constitution Hall in Washington by the Daughters of the American Revolution. And Eleanor Roosevelt, the president's wife, invited her to sing at the Lincoln Memorial on a Sunday, on Easter Sunday, before 50,000 people. And the audience saw Marian Anderson sing, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." Well, when the film ended, we had not anticipated, but everyone, as the lights came up, got on their feet and turned to the box and gave this ovation to Marian Anderson. And that proved to be true with each film that we showed over the next 37 years. So anyway, that's just one. I could go on, but casting and editing and all of the aspects of storytelling come into play with those live-to-tape performances.
Is it more difficult to tell a story in that 5 minutes as opposed to, you know, a feature-length film or a longer documentary? I imagine sometimes it is more difficult to put it in there. Did you find that was the case?
I think if it was a good discipline. You know, we were confined by time, and you surprise how effective you can be of giving people some. You can see some of those on YouTube and all. They're definitely worth looking at.
Something else I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned Sidney Poitier earlier, and in your book you talk about how you convinced him to do television instead of film, and kind of talking about the time there, you mentioned that you needed the 4 hours that television could provide to tell the story of Thurgood Marshall's quest to end legal segregation. And then, of course, you mentioned earlier that, you know, that ended up being separate but equal. But then later on, you also turned that into a Broadway play simply called Thurgood. So can you give us a peek into your process of telling a true story across multiple mediums? You're talking TV to on stage.
Yeah. Let's start with Sidney and your observation that he did not do television. And this is true of both The Murder of Mary Fagan and Separate But Equal, both of which won the Emmy for Outstanding Miniseries. Those were not subjects that you walked into a network and they said, "Oh, yep, that's what we want to do." You know, you had to say, "This is going to be really interesting. The Supreme Court is not going to be dull. This story of this unfortunate man who was lynched by the Ku Klux Klan in Leo Frank in The Murder of Mary Fagan." You know, they both say, "No, people aren't going to enjoy that." In each case, I wrote a script. One in collaboration with Larry McMurtry and Jeffrey Lane, called The Murder of Mary Fagan, and the other, Separate But Equal, I wrote myself. And I was able to go first to Jack, which preceded, was the first of my miniseries. And I was playing golf with him one day, and it was known that Jack did not do television. And on the fifth hole at Hillcrest, while we were walking down the fairway, I said, "Jack, I've done a piece that's a story about involved a very noble figure, Governor John Slayton, of Georgia. I know you don't do television normally, but this, I think, is a very distinguished piece. I wonder if you'd read it. And he said, sure, kid, send it over. And I went back, that was in Hollywood. I went back to Washington, and I was sitting in this house, and the phone rang about 7 o'clock one night. And he says, wow, he says, that's a great story. He says, yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah. He says, you're going to have to deal with my agent, Lenny Hirshon. He's a bit of a pain in the ass, but I think you can work something out. You know, so Jack just was captivated by this material and said yes, where he'd always said no to television. And the similar to Sydney, I went to him before I wrote it. I'd been to CBS, and they said, this sounds like a good story, but that you're not going to be able to cast it for a miniseries. And I said, well, what about Sidney Poitier? And they said, oh, we go to Sidney Poitier almost every year, and he just won't do television. They said, well, if you can, we've talked to Sidney, and if he says he'll read your script, we'll pay for it. Well, I went up to his house on Cove Way in Beverly Hills, and I told him what I had in mind and why I wanted him to do it, and that I understood his practice with respect to television. Sidney had a rather princely way of talking, and he looked at me and he said, if you come with a compelling script on this piece with Thurgood Marshall, I will do it. So I was sentenced. A writer's strike started, and I was able to write if I wasn't under contract to a studio. So I wrote the script and went back to him, and he said yes.
Wow. Did you feel some sort of extra pressure to that, since it was not only telling a good story, but also trying to convince Sidney that he was going to switch to do television?
You know, the script convinced him, and he had enough respect for me, even though I'd been directing Peter Gunn and Alfred Hitchcock and the location work for my father on The Diary of Anne Frank. But since I'd gone to the end of the government, I had not been directing, and I'd been producing television and writing. And I told ABC I was going to direct it, and they never batted an eye, and they were very pleased with the outcome.
Over the course of your career, what's something that stood out to you as like the biggest advancement in the film industry?
They were telling stories of pretty good when Buster Keaton was doing it, and my father was making Shane and Giant and A Place in the Sun, or Lawrence of Arabia for David Lean. Obviously, the cameras are smaller. On Shane, we had this enormous camera, and he shot that famous fight scene in the saloon in Shane that I think had 143 different cuts. And they were all shot with that huge Technicolor camera, whereas today you would have a small camera.
Yeah, which I think is fascinating too. It's almost another mindset thing, because I've heard, you know, just from my experience, I've heard a lot of artists and kind of getting into filmmaking, and they think that having the latest, greatest technology is going to help them create a better film. So I think it's fascinating that it's not that. It's not the technology that...
Okay, I would say this, that digital cameras have broadened the opportunity. Young people can make films. Old people can make films. That's the democratization of the use of the medium is a tremendous step forward.
Since you told so many stories for other people using a wide range of mediums, and then speaking of your book, you're telling your own story. Did you find yet another medium in writing a book and telling your own story? Did you find that to be a different type of challenge that was difficult?
Definitely a different kind of challenge. And everything is difficult, you know, trying to create something. But I'll tell you a story. My father, I was in the Air Force part of the time he was making Giant. I worked with him at the beginning and then through the editing. And it was a 3-hour and 20-minute film for which he won another Oscar. And the precision and the care he took with every aspect of making a film. But in the editing, he'd start at reel one and go through it and through it, and he'd find things and fix things, change. And after about a year sitting in a hot projection room with him, I said one day, "Dad, we've previewed this film twice. It is so good. Shouldn't you just put it out there and release it?" And he looked at me and he said, "Think of the man hours." He would have said man and woman hours today. "Think of the man hours that are going to be spent watching this film over the many years to come. Think of all that time. Don't you think it's worth we spend a little more of our time making it better for those people who are going to spend their time?" And I had that idea with my book. I found it that I just to keep working through it until they took it away from me. but I finally had COVID gave me time to make it become the book I wanted to write. And it wasn't until very near the end that I came upon the title, My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. My Place in the Sun, obviously being an homage to my father, whom I share the cover with.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about the mindset of filmmakers then of they didn't expect the films to last. And so it's telling how pioneering your father was to not have that same mindset to, you know, he was already thinking of longevity. And I love the, you know, standing the test of time.
Just to tell you that briefly, he and I went to the Academy Awards in 1952. Joseph L. Mankiewicz had won the previous year for All About Eve, and he read the nominations. John Huston for The African Queen, William Wyler for Detective Story, Vincent Minnelli for An American in Paris, Elia Kazan for A Streetcar Named Desire, and George Stevens for A Place in the Sun. Well, I wouldn't be telling you this if somebody else had won it. Riding home in the car that night, this Oscar was on the seat between us. And I was 18 years old. And he looked over at me and he said, "You know, we'll have a better idea what kind of a film this is in about 25 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, there were no Cinematheques, no DVDs. He had been in the theater with his father as a boy. Father was an actor, director. And, he understood what was important about a work of art. Now, he didn't know that the 18-year-old sitting next to him would one day be the founder of the American Film Institute and the Kennedy Center Honors, which are all about the test of time. But it was an idea that stuck with me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. You mentioned your book, My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington, and I'll make sure to include a link to that in the show notes for this episode. But before I let you go, at the book's end, you talk about continuing to ponder stories to turn into film. And since your book is filled with stories from your life, I thought it would be fitting to wrap up our chat today by asking you, what story from your life do you think would make a great film?
Well, I have a story that I'm working on that I think more to the benefit of the public is not about my life, but about two great figures in American history that I cannot name for you at this moment for practical reasons, that I'm excited to be engaged again. It will be a long movie for streaming, several seasons. And I would only add as a postscript to that My Place in the Sun is now available on audiobook with my voice. And if you didn't like my voice today, I suggest you not listen to it. Thank you. I really enjoyed this discussion.
Thank you so much, George. This episode of Based on a True Story was produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. I'd like to thank George Stevens Jr. once again for sharing some of his stories from the history of Hollywood and Washington. And if you want to learn even more captivating stories from George, check out his book called My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. And as he mentioned at the end, now there's an audiobook version with George narrating it. As a podcaster, it's probably not too much of a surprise. That's my preferred method. And I absolutely loved hearing George's voice telling the stories from his book. As always, you can find a link to it in the show notes for this episode, as well as on the show's home on the web, basedonatruestorypodcast.com. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a quick refresher, here are the two truths and one lie again. Number one, George was the first to see the morning of D-Day in color since those who were there that day. Number two, the name My Place in the Sun is an homage to George's father. Number three, JFK never talked to George. Did you catch which one is a lie? Let's start with number one. George was the first to see the morning of D-Day in color since those who were there that day. That is true. As George told us, his father, George Sr., landed on the beaches of Normandy charged with shooting footage of the war in Europe. And some of the footage was shot in color, but George Sr. did not want to watch the footage when he got home from the war. So when George Jr. watched the color footage, he realized that except for those who were there on June 6, 1944, he was the first to see the beaches of Normandy from that morning in color. If you want to watch some of the footage yourself, check out the story of his father's life called George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey. And you can see even more of the World War II footage that George Sr. shot in another film that George Jr. directed about his father called George Stevens, D-Day to Berlin. That brings us to number two. The name, My Place in the Sun, is an homage to George's father. That is also true. George Stevens Sr. directed a film called A Place in the Sun that was released in 1951, and it earned him an Oscar for directing, one of the six Oscars that film won out of nine nominations. That means number three is the lie. JFK never talked to George. One of the great stories that we heard George tell was about the time that he got called out of a meeting so he could take a call with President John F. Kennedy. And on the phone, JFK told George that one of the documentaries he being George, produced, called The Five Cities of June, was one of the best that he'd ever seen. Oh, and George Jr. was nominated for an Oscar for that documentary, too. I hope you've enjoyed learning about George's career and getting a peek into some Hollywood history as much as I have. If you want to hear more stories from Hollywood's history, let me know. You can find me hanging out in the Based on a True Story Discord over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/discord. Last but not least, if you get value out of Based on a True Story, you can give back whatever you feel it's worth. Or you can learn how to get ad-free versions of the show over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.